Talkback with Gary Null, Sundays at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day. Oh, happy day. When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, I'm going to set most of the time aside to hear what your feelings about the state of your life, the world, what you believe is possible, what you're doing to make it a better world, and what alliances you've created, what new insights you have gained, and how you are now hopefully entering a new passage. And not just listening on the radio to this or any other program by progressive-minded individuals, because we have to do more, and we have to work together. When you stop and think of all the bad legislators, and all the stupid laws, and all the excess manipulation of our lives by the media, where we're nothing more than commodities. Over 41% of Americans are independent thinkers. They are conscientious. There's just not the organization yet. I believe that will change. I believe things are going to get a lot worse, and this week, all this week, every single day, I have conversations with remarkable minds lined up to share their views of what's going to happen over the next 12 months. I'll be sharing mine at the same time, including a commentary tomorrow. Dude, where's my job? You'll hear that. Also, tonight, you're going to hear two short commentaries. One, A New Year's Resolution for the Rich, by Sam Harris, Huffington Post. And the second, by Tycund Magazine's Rabbi Michael Lerner, The State of the Spirit, 2011. But let's get it started by having you share your thoughts, your insights, your opinions. I like a forum where people have a chance to talk back, and this is your chance. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Just one little interesting story. When I am doing the work I do, I don't celebrate any holiday. One day is simply as important as the next, and I look at every one of the hours in that day as significant. Recently, most of my time has either been spent driving, flying, filming, or writing about what I have filmed. I'm finishing up three major films. In the past year, I was able to complete and submit to my publisher in the last 4 weeks 9 major manuscripts. And each one of those manuscripts will have a featured film going with it, something new and really revolutionary in publishing. I also finished 3 feature films, none of which have been released yet, and I'm finishing up 2 more. 2 of those I can discuss. One is called Poverty, Inc., and it's about the new type of poor in America and why we have chosen not to focus on it. The media, left and right, virtually ignores it. But in my travels and in my efforts to tell their story, to be a voice for the voiceless, this is just one example, and this is from New Year's Eve. A group of people who had historically would have been at parties or out enjoying the celebration, instead, we're being filmed talking about what it's like in a area of Silicon Valley, historically very upward mobile, meaning people generally making between $150 to millions a year. And there's a certain expectation when you live in that community. Two young women, their mother and father. The father was a very successful consulting engineer in Silicon Valley and was making about $500,000 a year. The mother is also in the field, and together they brought in about $800,000. That's a lot of money. Needless to say, the children went to a private school, and they had to keep increasing their standard of living until he was laid off. Then, instead of taking an honest look at where they were at in their life and saying, all right, what can we afford and not afford, and shouldn't we be scaling back? Instead, their biggest concern, and you'll see in the film them explaining this, was that in that community, and that means anywhere in America, in an upper mobile community, you're only as significant to other people as your materialistic. In other words, your new cars, homes, how much you spent, where you shop. So now they don't have the income, but they have to keep spending as if they did. And I ask, why? And they gave an example of a family where the parent lost the income, the primary parent lost the income for who was bringing in the money. And one of their friends of 15 years could no longer be their friend because she could no longer afford to do the things, buy the things the others could. So they simply made her persona non grata. She didn't exist anymore. And I said, well, that's really cold, isn't it? And you'll hear something rather remarkable. On the one hand, this Generation Y, they have no intellect, they have no manners, they have no morality, they have no ethics. In fact, I shouldn't say this, I'm writing a new chapter in my book called Generation Sub-Zero. Now, of course, there are exceptions. And I actually balance that with, you know, a requiem for a generation that's lost. She says, we're selfish. But why shouldn't we be? You know, we were given everything and told that we were perfect. So why did we do anything to disagree with that? Anytime I wanted anything, I got it. And no matter what I did, it was absolutely perfect because my whole family was into feeling good. And so mom was on Paxil, dad was on marijuana, we were on our Ritalin, and we were all over the place, and we rarely spent any time together. It was all about this. So get this. Then a year goes by, the father does not get work, and there was a very important event coming up each year. It was like a celebrity social auction where they auction off things. And they spent $30,000 getting ready for the auction because they had to have new clothes. And they had then to buy something at the auction to show that they were still viable. Because they'd been keeping secret that they were out of work and hurting. And I said, so what was your financial position when you spent this $30,000? And the father said, it was one of the most bizarre days of my life. I'm looking at the fact that we had drained out our entire savings. I had cashed in 401k. We were 3 months behind on mortgage payments. I'm looking at about $400,000 in debt. And I just went out and laid all this money because everyone says, well, Dad, we have to, you know. And one of the girls says, look, we realize that if we didn't keep up the front, we would then look just like our former girlfriend. So it was all about maintaining a facade. Well, today, another year and 2 months later, the family has lost everything. And now they are the new homeless. Highly educated, once very successful, and today they're getting meals in soup kitchens. Well, that represents one extreme of the new poor. More often than not, it's now affecting the professional class. They're not on soup lines, most, but they're cutting back and they're having to reorganize their financing. And all this is virtually invisible to the American public. But then there's an awful lot of people. I'm talking about over 100 million people who never had the big money. They live modestly, and now they don't have anything, and they're struggling. No one's being helped. So, my commentary, and then we're going to go to your calls. And I'd like to hear your opinions. Our number again, here on the Progressive Radio Network, for all of you to call in, 888-874-4888. While the United States has suffered the worst recession in living memory, I find that I have very few financial concerns. This is Sam Harris. I'm reading his commentary. Many of my friends are in the same position. Most of us attended private schools and good universities. And we will be able to provide these same opportunities to our own children. No one in my immediate circle has a family member serving in Afghanistan, Iraq. In fact, in the aftermath of September 11th, the only sacrifice we were asked to make for our beloved country was to go shopping. Nearly a decade has passed with our nation's influence and infrastructure crumbling by the hour. And yet those of us who have been so fortunate as to live the American dream, rather than merely dream it, have been spared every inconvenience. Now we're told that we will soon receive a large tax cut for our own troubles. What is the word for the feeling that provokes in me? Imagine being safely sealed in a encapsulated lifeboat while countless others drowning around you, only to learn that another lifeboat has been secured to take your luggage to shore. Most Americans believe that a person should enjoy the full fruits of their labors, however abundant. In this light, taxation tends to be seen as an intrinsic evil. Now, it's worth noting, however, that throughout the 1950s, a decade for which American conservatives pretend to feel a harrowing sense of nostalgia, the marginal tax rate for the wealthy was over 90%. That's right, 90% of what you earned you gave to the government. In fact, prior to the 1980s, it never dipped below 70%. Since 1982, however, it has come down by half. In the meantime, the average net worth of the richest 1% of Americans has doubled to $18 million for the average wealthy American, while that of the poorest 40% has fallen by 63% to $2,200 a year. You heard me right. The poorest 40% of Americans live on $2,200 a year, the richest $18 million. 30 years ago, top U.S. executives made about 50 times the salary of their average employees. And yet now it's an enormous 600 times different. We now live in a country in which the bottom 40%, that's 120 million people, own just 0.3% of the wealth. Data of this kind make one feel that one is participating in a vast psychological experiment. Just how much inequality can free people endure? Have you seen Ralph Lauren's car collection? Yes, it's beautiful. It also costs hundreds of millions of dollars. So what? Many people say it's his money. He earned it. He should be able to do whatever he wants with it. In conservative circles, expressing any doubt on this point has long been synonymous with Marxism. And yet over 1 million American children are now living on the streets. They are homeless. People on Medicare are being denied life-saving organ transplants that are routinely covered before the recession. Over one quarter of our nation's bridges are structurally deficient. When might be a convenient time to ask the richest Americans to help solve problems of this kind? It's easy to understand why even the most generous person might be adverse to paying taxes. Our legislative process has been held hostage to short-term political interest and other perverse incentives for as long as anyone can remember. Consequently, our government wastes an extraordinary amount of money. It almost seems uncontroversial to say that whatever can be best accomplished in the private sector should be. Our tax code must also be reformed. And it might even be true that the income tax should be lowered on everyone, provided that we find a better source of revenue to pay our bills. But I can't imagine that anyone seriously believes that the current level of wealth inequality in the United States is good and worth maintaining, or that our government's first priority should be to spare a privileged person like myself the slightest hardship as this once great nation falls into ruin. The ruination of the United States really does seem possible. It has been widely reported, for instance, that students in Shanghai far surpass our own in science, reading, and math. In fact, when compared to other countries, American students are now disconcertingly average. In fact, we're below average in math, where the average includes utopias like Kyrgyzstan and Albania and Indonesia. President Obama was right to recognize this as a Sputnik moment. But is it worth that? This story was immediately followed by a report about giddy creationists in the state of Kentucky being offered $40 million in tax subsidies to produce full-scale model of Noah's Ark. More horrible still, this ludicrous use of public money is probably a wise investment, given that such a monument to scientific ignorance will be guaranteed to attract an oven influx of Christian tourists from neighboring states. Seeing facts of this kind juxtaposed without irony or remedy at this dire moment in history, it is hard not to feel that one is witnessing America's irreversible decline. Needless to say, most Americans have no choice but to send their children to terrible schools, where they will learn the lesser part of nothing and emerge already beggared by a national debt now is on course to reach $20 trillion. And yet Republicans in every state can successfully campaign on a promise to spend less on luxuries like education while delivering tax cuts to people who, if asked to guess their own net worth, would not come within $10 million, the correct figure, if their lives depended on it. America's opposition to the redistribution of wealth has achieved the luster of religious creed. And, as with all religions, one finds the faithful witlessly espousing doctrines that harm almost everyone, including their own children. For instance, while most Americans have no chance of earning or inheriting significant wealth, 68% want the estate tax eliminated, and 31% consider it the worst and least fair tax levied by the federal government. Most believe that limiting this tax, which affects only 0.2% of the population, should be a top priority of the current Congress. The truth, however, is that everyone must favor the redistribution of wealth at some point. This relates directly to the issue of education. As the necessity of doing boring and dangerous work disappears, whether because we have built better machines or infrastructure or shipped our least desirable jobs overseas, people need to be better educated so they can apply themselves to more interesting work. Who will pay for this? There is only one group of people who can pay for anything at this point: the wealthy. To make matters more difficult, Americans have made a religious fetish of something called self-reliance. Most seem to think that while a person may not be responsible for the opportunities he gets in life, each is entirely responsible for what he makes of these opportunities. This is, without question, a false view of the human condition. Consider the biography of any self-made American, from Benjamin Franklin on down, and you'll find that his success was entirely dependent upon background conditions that he did not make and of which he was a mere beneficiary. There is not a person on earth who chose his genome or the country of his birth or the political and economic conditions that prevailed at moments crucial to his progress. Consequently, no one is responsible for his intelligence, range of talents, or ability to do productive work. If you have struggled to make the most of what nature gave you, you must still admit that nature also gave you the ability and inclination to struggle. How much credit do I deserve for not having Down syndrome or any other disorder that would make my current work impossible? None whatsoever. And yet devotees of self-reliance rail against those who would receive entitlements of various sorts, like health care, education, etc., while feeling unself-consciously entitled to their relative good fortune. Yes, we must encourage people to work to the best of their abilities and discourage free riders wherever we can, but it seems only decent at this moment to admit how much luck is required to succeed at anything in this life. Those who have been especially lucky, the smart, well-connected, and rich, should count their blessings and then share some of those blessings with the rest of society. The wealthiest Americans often live as though they and their children had nothing to gain from investments in education infrastructure, clean energy, and scientific research. For instance, the billionaire Steve Ballmer, CEO of Microsoft, recently helped kill a proposition that would have created an income tax for the richest 1% in Washington, one in seven states that has no income tax. All of these funds would have gone to improve the state's failing schools. What kind of society does Ballmer want to live in? One that is teeming with poor, uneducated people? Who does he expect to buy his products? Where will he find his next batch of software engineers? Perhaps Ballmer is simply worried that the government will spend his money badly. After all, we currently spend more than almost every other country on education with abysmal results. Well, then we should say so, and rather than devote hundreds of thousands of dollars to stoking anti-tax paranoia in the state, he should direct some of his vast wealth towards improving education, like his colleague Bill Gates has done. There are, in fact, some signs that a new age of heroic philanthropy might be dawning. Now, in conclusion, I am aware that a proposal of any kind to clean up our air is going to be fought by the wealthy. But what's the top wealthiest Americans from sponsoring a 21st century renaissance? What politician would object to our immediately spending $1 trillion on improving in education and energy security? Perhaps there are even better targets for this money. In the quote, and that was from Sam Harris, obviously a well-to-do person who is now looking with some concern about what could be done with the money that he has been able to have in his life. And that's good. I'm glad to see that there are people who are conscientious. I'm Gary Knoll, but we're going to find out what's on your mind, the issues that are important to you. We're coming back in a moment to take your calls now. Our number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Anyhow, my filming on New Year's Eve went virtually until 4 in the morning, and I'm glad to say that I believe that after the filming I had a chance to share some perspectives with people about what it means to be poor. Hopefully that will have been some inspiration for them, because they were thinking because they had nothing material, they had nothing. Oh, that's far from true. Let's hear your thoughts now. 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Gary.
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I listen to your program constantly, and I want to thank you very much. You provide wonderful information to all of us. Thanks a million for that. I have a question for you. Some time ago, I heard you speaking about a piece of property that you almost bought. It was a beautiful piece of property. And then at the last moment, you had a change of mind. You said that there was some negative energy there. And I was concerned. I would just like to know in general, could you please tell me how one can know if there is negative energy, say, in an apartment or house? Let's say that one is living in an apartment or house, if there's negative energy or if you're about to take a house or property, how would you be able to know that?
virtually all the property that I purchased in my lifetime, I have purchased it based upon how I felt about it. Now, all of us have intuition. No one is without it. And the intuition is the window between all that is present today in your conscious mind, all your senses, what you see and feel and can experience, and the window into our soul. And it is through this window that intuition sends us a message about people and events and things. There have been times in my life where I've had opportunities. One was a $25 million contract. I said no to it. Everyone thought it was stupid because it would have led to about $500 million. You heard me right, a half a billion dollars. And when I said no to it, I told Gary Krupp, the person that arranged it, I said, Gary, there is something about this man that I'm intuitively reading. I don't want to be a part of it. He said, well, it's stupid. It's all nonsense. You know, you should take it. And I didn't. It turned out I was right. The person had a really bad background. But the person who did take advantage of that ended up making $500 million. That other person I knew very well. I don't care about the opportunities that do not work in my life. I care about the ones that do. I remember with one particular home, it was aesthetically far superior than the one that I purchased, but I didn't like the way it felt. I was not getting the right vibe. The one I did purchase, I got the right vibe, and then it took me a year to clean the land and get it all together, and then it was magnificent. And so when I'm in a community where I see that the energy feels right, it feels, you just feel so relaxed, you feel joy, you feel a certain excitement, then the energy is right. And that means that the universe is telling you you're in synchronicity. Now, more often than not, we don't go by these feelings. Instead, we go by opportunity and conditioning. And then we try to sell ourselves into that we're making the right choice, even when intuitively we know we're not. And then when the things start to happen we didn't want to have happen, we don't look and say, gee whiz, why didn't I make another choice? Because more often than not, we're compulsive. We're not patient. We want what we want. We want it now. I've sold homes that other people thought, this is stupid. Why did you sell this? Because the energy just didn't feel right. And for me, everything is energy. Everything I do is energy. When I'm behind a camera and I'm filming, one of the reasons I believe that my films have been so successful, I've won almost 400 awards, and that's right up there in the top three or four filmmakers, documentarians in American history, is because I know when someone is telling me the truth. I know when I have one of those remarkable moments. I feel it. I call it the ooh-ah moment. And I know when I don't have it. The energy's not there. In fact, I remember it was the Sarasota International Film Festival about 6 years ago. And I submitted AIDS, Inc., a film I had done. And there were about 220 films or so, including feature films and documentaries. And they have categories, like 9 different categories, best short, best animation, etc. And then they have best of festival, meaning of all the films, there's a $5,000 prize in that. And I submitted mine under the documentaries. Michael Moore had one in there, and Al Pacino, I think, had George III. There were a lot of good documentaries. And I ended up winning Best Documentary, but Best of Festival, meaning of all the films. I think I got a $5,000 award. And when I asked later, I said, why did you select this? And this older gentleman, who is one of the judges, and you don't know who the judges are before, or what their background is, he said, this touched me. This was real. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. Well, what was touching him? The energy, the message. Just like a painting. You can't get it out of your mind. Or photograph. Or poem. Or performance. Like Nureyev, the ballet. We are gifted in life by having every single moment of a day impact us constructively or destructively, positively or negatively. Some are very subtle energies and some are very strong energies. But it's all cumulative. It's cumulative towards the positive or cumulative towards the negative. No one just wakes up one day and looks at their partner beside them in bed and saying, "You're so loving, you're so beautiful, you're so warm, you're so giving, get the hell out of my life." Instead, one day, someone says something or does something, and we say, "That's it. It's over." Someone says, "Why? What's the big deal?" And then they try to find meaning in that last umbrage instead of saying, "It was the 1,000th cut." You destroy a relationship with each negative statement, with each critical and abusive energy. And then one day, it is enough. There's a magic number in the universe. And each circumstance and each situation is different. Have an alcoholic in your family. Have a drug addict in your family. I've counseled thousands. And ask them, how many times did you give another chance and another chance? And you were sure, and they hoping that when they said, "I won't do it again," but they did it again. When is finally the magic number where that's it, the door closes? We almost never think of the job that we work in, or the place we live, or the people that we have in our lives. But we should. Because one of the things that is happening now is that we have to ask ourselves, are we still seeking the right partner, the right religion, the right job, the right person, instead of evolving into the right authentic person we should be, and therefore internalize our journey rather than externalize it? And what are our myths? What is your relationship to your apartment, or food, or your body image, or to the environment around you? And how often have you, rather than be honest about what your intuition was telling you, how many times have you rewritten your story so that you could appease any guilt or fear or insecurity by not changing, staying in the same place, staying in the wrong place, and you simply rewrote your story? What happens is, more often than not, we become maladaptive. We adapt to bad situations until we become maladaptive. Now, there is an impact because there is an effect on us. And then we will frequently see people who are morally self-righteous condemning others, which they shouldn't. And almost always these are people who are terrified of seeing the myths within their own beliefs, the contradictions. So look carefully at your life and look for the turning points in your life. And the turning point is a new chapter. The excitement of rebuilding our tomorrow, which we can do now at the beginning of this year. The awakening of our conscious process to keep ourselves focused in the moment we're in. The type of rapid social and personal change that's possible, the intellectual, moral, and creative achievements that we're capable of, breaking through, using a crisis to break through, but don't make a crisis out of everything. Do you realize how many people, they have mastered the art of creating crisis when they don't get what they want, so everything is suddenly a crisis? When you're simply being by yourself and alone in quiet time, that's when the truth is revealed. Everything, everyone is seen with an honest insight. And then therefore you can surrender your depression or apathy or your anger, your rage, your denialism, your avoidance. You can be a kinder and nicer person. Or you can continue being selfish, saying, "I deserve." Let me tell you, friend, before you tell yourself and the world around you what you feel entitled to, people's time or energy, you're entitled to nothing. Zero. Start from scratch. Get rid of the myths. And then say, I'm entitled to what I can create. I will no longer mortgage my future to my fear. I will not base my self-worth upon what I own or who's in my life. I will take appropriate risks, but I will not make inappropriate risks. I do not live in excess. I will live with what is important for me in this moment. And then when you do that, and you're able to take that kind of self-evaluation, then one day you wake up and you realize that you can change. Authentic change. See, people confuse what they do with who they are. You're more relevant than your work or your possessions. So step back from where you live and ask yourself, how do you feel about not only where you live, but the people in your life and what you're doing? It may be time to change everything. Or at least be honest about what you need to change and no longer give it justifications or rationalizations. Does that give you a better insight?
Thank you so much, Gary. It's very helpful.
When I was finished on New Year's Eve filming, one of the women said to me, my God, you know, why didn't we think of this ourselves? And I said, because you had mastered the art of illusion. Everything in your life was an illusion. Now it's real. So don't be angry about what you don't have today. Be happy that at least you're no longer living in that illusion with all those other people, because it was all one big game. Let's say hello to June from Stony Brook. Hi, June.
I have a question about this recently passed food safety bill. I'm not quite clear on the details and how it's going to affect my ability to purchase fresh organic food and herbs.
Here is what it means. First, understand what the bill does. The bill was sponsored by the genetic engineering company and the large major food people. Why? Because no different than the pharmaceutical industry that makes hundreds of billions of dollars in profit each year, it is still feeling that any vitamin you could buy is competition. Because if you could buy echinacea and pal d'arco, colloidal silver, and wild oregano oil, quercetin, and bitter melon, and take that along with vitamin D to prevent the cold or flu, then you're not going to take their flu medications. And the same is true for arthritis, or heart disease, or cancer. So they are concerned that there is freedom of choice, and that there's actually competition in the marketplace. And American business, corporate, major corporations, do not like competition. They like monopolies and trust. So they've been working to stop our freedom of choice. They have failed up to this point. But now with the passage of Codex, as of April 1st of this coming year now that we're in, over 1,100 items will cease to be available for sale in all of the European Union countries. You will not be able in Germany and Italy and Spain to go in and buy whatever vitamin C you want or zinc. You won't be able to buy at all herbs or coenzyme Q10, and you'll be able to buy 1 milligram of B1 and 1.5 milligrams of B2, virtually worthless. Now, in order to hit us on many levels simultaneously, they want to go after the food, and they've been working on this, so that the only food that you'll be allowed to purchase or even to grow and sell would be food that would have to have the ability to have massive safety quality control checks, but just the equipment that would be required would be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And then they went one step further. If you make an error in any bookkeeping part at all, entry, you could go to jail for 10 years. So Now that literally puts the fear in every single small farmer, which means that the amount of money they would have to make by selling organic produce could not possibly be done because of how much oversight they would have and how now Homeland Security is involved. The FDA will now hire thousands upon thousands of inspectors to go and look at the food production facility. So virtually all the small people within the next 2 years will cease to exist. That means then that the only food that you'll be able to get will be genetically engineered, irradiated food, food grown on human waste sludge. But what they're likely to do is they're likely then to modify the organic food standards to allow their food to be called organic, even though by no measure is it. They, once you begin to play the system, you own the system, and they own all the Republicans and the Democrats. They did not have any viable voices against them. So what this means is that I'm going to guess 2 years by the outside, the very outside, you won't be able to go in and buy any of the produce. Now, you'll be able to grow your own produce, but then who's going to sell you the organic seeds? Ah, in order to sell organic seeds, heirloom seeds, you're now going to have to qualify under all the different strict standards that only a major genetics engineering seed company would be able to do. Well, then that's going to put all the small organic seed people out of business, heirloom seeds. And that means there will not be any more organic gardening in the United States. Then, within 2.5 to 3 years, I see all vitamins and herbs in America being banned. All. It is not will it happen, it is inevitable it's going to happen, it's just when. It is absolutely 100% inevitable. They will overcome the Deshaies Amendment because the World Trade Organization and Codex have seniority as a treaty. It has the top standing in any legal dispute in the United States. So the next 2 years is all you have to eat organic produce and to take your supplements. Now, for the average American, they don't care. Do they look like they care? Do they look like they care about anything except who's going to win a ball game and who's going to beat someone up in the Mortal Kombat, or, you know, they're gone. This is 1984, George Orwell. They're already drinking the Kool-Aid. And interestingly enough, these are not the best and brightest, and these are not the educated, but these are people who are living in complete abandonment of any moral character. They don't demonstrate, they're selfish. Except for about 7% of the people. They do care. That's the truth of it. So on one hand, the worse it gets, a lot of you will be able to say, you know, couldn't they have seen it coming? Oh yeah. They saw it coming. But they're watching Katrina. They're lost in that virtual reality state. And you think, yeah, but it's... they're making choices that go against their own needs. Yeah, they are. And that's a part of the lesson. When will they change? When they reach the magic number. What is that number? For each person is different. So for all the 6 million people who did call in, thank you. For the people who did protest, again, we had 6 million people, probably 3 million from this audience. I want to thank them because you did make a good fight. So we have to increase our strategies in the coming year. We have to write more hard-hitting articles, do documentaries. Why do you think I'm doing this? Why do you think I'm working 20 hours a day traveling? Because, well, let me think. Who else is doing it? You've got Chris Hedges, who's out there. You have Gerald Salante. You have probably about 2,000 or 3,000 people in all of America who are actually on a regular basis committing themselves to challenging, with great risk, the status quo. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Karen from New Jersey. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Gary. I love your Sunday night show.
Thank you.
Do you have any ideas of what killed the 1,000 birds in Arkansas that fell out of the sky that they thought may have had stress from fireworks, or maybe, what was the other excuse they used in the news? It just seems so ridiculous.
Karen, I can't answer that because I haven't been looking at any of the news for the last about 8 days, so I'm out of the loop. But if you email me, I haven't even looked at my emails. I've got about, what I was told, 27,000 emails I got to get to. So I'll get to the emails and I'll take a look at what you're talking about, and then I'll try to make some sense out of it and give you an answer next Sunday, all right? All the best to you, Karen. I was just told Dr. Martin Feldman's online. I've been waiting on him. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Gary.
Marty, talk about manganese.
Yes, you were talking about life myths. I have a lot of medical myths. They're all over the place, and they're very serious, almost as serious as life myths. One basic one is about manganese. First off, conventional doctors think, well, it's a very minor micronutrient mineral. It's just a side mineral. Don't worry about it. It's very important. It's not a micro mineral. It's an important mineral. And just a few of the specific reasons why people need it is as follows. Even with a glucose level above 95 and especially above 125, above 125 is diabetes. Above 95 is a big problem in terms of future. And most of the people that I've tested who have either above 95 or especially above 125 have a deficiency of this manganese, very, very important. They also may have a deficiency of B-complex and chromium and zinc in the bargain, but the manganese is part of the deal. Next would be connective tissue issues, and these are rampant, carpal tunnel being one major one, whereby there are patients I see all the time come in carpal tunnel, and the manganese and the B6, especially those two together, help a great deal. The third is pancreatic enzyme problems, whereby those people who have trouble with pancreatic enzymes tend to have very low manganese. Last is SOD, superoxide dismutase, a major free radical fixer, very basic level related to the manganese. What are some of the foods for the manganese that are important? Well, vegetarians do very well with that compared to other persons. Some of the best sources are as follows: nuts and seeds, whole grains, dark leafy greens, especially spinach, mustard greens, and kale. Peas and beans have manganese, but you have to be careful because, for example, if they refine wheat into white flour, 90% of the manganese is lost in the process. What about some of the nutrients that we have in terms of just supplementary? Well, it's very simple. There are a few major ones. There's a gluconate, a citrate, and an amino acid chelate. And they all seem to do pretty well, but again, the traditional physicians are very stupid about the doses. You often have to start manganese at 5 milligrams just for openers. And commonly, if we have any of the issues whereby it's in deficiency, you can go up to 35 or even 50 milligrams short term. And it is a little bit hard to absorb, so we may often have to tune up the digestive process to get the manganese into the system. So we have here a myth about a very important mineral, manganese, food-related, who needs it, and some of the supplementary ideas and some of the dose ideas.
Okay, that's good, Marty. And if people would like to speak with Martin Feldman about any of these issues, you can reach Marty at 212-744-4413. Thank you, Marty.
Okay, Gary.
Next up, we have Mike Rupert here, and is Michael up? I'd like to say hello to him, see what he's going to be talking about on his show this evening.
I'm here, Gary. We have a great guest tonight, Tom Brown Jr., the legendary tracker, lives over in New Jersey there. He's written 147 million books, and he is revered. He has an amazing following, and he teaches people all kinds of things about themselves, the world they live in, and how to survive in the wilderness, and how to find a lot of parts of yourself you didn't know you had. So he's going to be on with me right after you.
Oh, good. Well, we're looking forward to that. And also, give us your quick prediction for what you see happening in the next 12 months. We'll make it that concise.
Well, I'm going to go much more specific than that. It's clear from newspapers and journals around the world now that a major oil price spike is on the way. On the last few trading hours of New Year's Eve, futures contracts went vertical, and the fuel shortages are now turning up all over the world. We're going to see a major economic event here in a very short period of time. Europe is still melting down, and at least two airlines are going down this year. That's an easy one.
All right. Well, what would this mean for the average person is like flying? Since if the airlines go down and the price of oil goes up, that means it's going to cost more to fly.
Yeah, it's going to kick business travel in the cojones. But that's a minor problem. I mean, Canadians are already paying $5 a gallon for gas, and their dollar is on par with ours. This is very, very, very tough right now. The European collapse is probably going to be felt very hard this next week. It hasn't gone away over the holiday.
Okay, last issue for you before we close out our show and then you begin yours. We have been told by most of the mainstream financial media that there's not only not a problem, but because of this this financial easing, this giving $3.3 trillion by the Federal Reserve, that has helped stabilize all the banks, including many of the banks in the European Union, and that even Estonia wants to get in the European Union. What do you see happening to the European Union, specifically the big countries?
The EU itself is history. It cannot survive this, and I'm in very good economic company around the world with this. The debt contagion that has begun is spreading, and it's now threatening some of the larger nations in Europe. And what's happening is China is stepping forth now, trying to offer some bailouts, and there appears to be a quid pro quo for that, which is that the EU will lift its weapons embargo and sales of technology, embargo on technology sales to China. So this is getting sporty.
Well, that's interesting. Well, we look forward to listening to your program and your guests. Coming up in just 30 seconds, Michael Rupert. I'm Gary Nall. Look forward to sharing more with you tomorrow at noon. Have a good day, everyone.